Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
To another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today we're going to be discussing a very important topic, great power competition and the myth of Russian influence in Africa. Today I'm joined by a very special guest, Chris Ogumodede. Chris is an editor, analyst, and consultant with World Politics Review. Chris has traversed the breadth of the African continent, where he regularly seeks stories and write about African politics, security, and foreign relations, especially related to West Africa. Chris, you've written extensively on African affairs more generally. I'm pleased to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Brilliant, brilliant. So in the aftermath of, the United States emerging victorious after nearly, 50 years of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, following the collapse of Yugoslavia in the late 80s or early 90s, we've seen a decline in foreign powers support for authoritarian regime in Africa. But there seems to be a reversal in the last couple of years, maybe the last 10 years or so. So there seems to be a resurgence of authoritarian regimes through direct military coup. And we've seen an increased geopolitical competition in the continent. So what are the factors driving this? That's one. And who are the major actors in this new space and what role do they play?
Well, I think it's always very important to, when we have these discussions, think about the way this great power competition in the post-Cold War era emerged. So obviously, as you set up correctly, you talked about how the Cold War ended and then the sort of Manichaean way that great powers, the West on one side, the NATO alliance, as it were, the US and its European allies and Canada and the Iron Curtain thought about, international partnerships. So that, calculation changed. The US, for instance, stopped believing in sticking with partners at all costs. So you have a scenario where several on the continent, the African continent, for instance, several partners like South Africa, Congo, Liberia, were essentially thrown overboard, because the US simply, calculus for, dealing with their worst instincts for a greater good, quote unquote, that calculus changed. So there was really no need, to put it crudely, to, stick with them at all costs. So the US could then impose new conditions on them. In the case of South Africa, it was dismantling apartheid. In the case of Congo, it was moving toward a multi-party election, and most other countries, actually, including Kenya, were essentially forced to go into multi-party elections, because at that time on the continent, the majority of governments were either military regimes, single party states, or in the case of Southern Africa, white minority governments like South Africa, Rhodesia, later Zimbabwe, and Mozambique before 1974. So all of that changed. The US simply didn't see the world in that black and white sense any longer, and it could impose its Pax Americana view of the world, you know, liberal democracy, free market enterprise, and all of those things. So you had the US in its unipolar moment thinking, you know, the view, its view of the world could be imposed in Africa. So they had to go to elections. Also, it's important to also consider that most African countries by like 1991 had structural adjustment programs. That's a very, very important element in all of this that I surprisingly do not hear enough talked about. Most of these countries had a double pill to take. Structural adjustment on the economic front, multi-party election on the other. This was believed to be the means by which they will shift into prosperity. In reality, it didn't quite work out like that for a number of reasons. You know, for one, most of these countries didn't have the state capacity to do either of those things, you know, to have, you know, free market economics or multi-party elections. They'd simply not been prepared to do so. Many of these countries were, you know, at most 2 decades old, because, you know, most of them started to get their independence in the 1960s. They hadn't had the time to develop, you know, the state into a capable entity. Then, you know, the economic downturn of the late 70s and 80s, which, you know, necessitated structural adjustment. So they were in no place to do that. So what you have in the 1990s is states swallowing pills that were too bitter for their mouths. So they have these multi-party elections. They have these, they take these structural adjustment programs. Those things decimate livelihoods. People get poorer. It weakens the state immeasurably. Many countries have these elections where, you know, entrenched interests from previous regimes come back to power, or newer interests that were created in the interim, right, in the interregnum between, you know, the independence and the multi-party election era. So essentially what you have is a situation where many of these countries experience economic growth. They experience all of these things, but it's not evened out. It's not, you know, collective. It's not shared. The prosperity is not shared. You know, they had, of course, they had many pre-existing societal conflicts, tensions between communities, ethnic groups, and all of these things. So by the turn of the millennium, by 2008, when the great financial crisis happens, whatever little gains they had experienced from all this so-called transition is frittered. That's when in places like the Sahel, you start to see radical jihadist movements come to the fore. Certainly in places like Nigeria, because if you remember, 2009 is when the Boko Haram menace starts, you know, in earnest in Nigeria. A couple of years down the line, in other parts of West Africa, you start to see other jihadist elements. In Mali, all of this, in fact, I've just written a piece on Mali on Friday that sort of looks at where things are now and how everything starts in 2012, you know, to talk about what I'm saying about the end of the 2000s is where the mistakes of the transition, quote unquote, starts to be reviewed. That's when, you know, the West starts to think of counterterrorism as the next field of engagement on the African continent. For the West, the changing, the white swan, the black swan moment, rather, was 9/11, right? 9/11 happens. You know, it upends the way that the US thinks about that unipolar moment I just described, where they will impose all of these good things on the world and everything will be fine. 9/11 is the wake-up call that the US gets that was a bad idea, or at least it didn't quite work out. So the US thinks counterterrorism is the next thing and starts to impose that on, you know, African countries, at least hotspots that it looked at as flashpoints for terrorist activity. So that's East Africa, Somalia, North Africa specifically, and then later on the Sahel, and of course North Africa. So that's where the US sort of takes an interest again in Africa, because between the Cold War and 9/11, U.S. interest in Africa declines, considerably speaking. It shifts towards humanitarian assistance and all of these things, but by and large, it doesn't go beyond that. The U.S. looks at Africa as Europe's problem, quote unquote, and it still does to a large extent, actually. They look at, you know, Africa as that's for the Europeans to deal with. We'll, you know, we'll continue to enjoy our unipolar moment. And, you know, in the U.S. in the 90s, there was all this talk of a peace dividend, right, where the U.S. Mm-hmm. would shrink its defense spending, you know, reduce its international military engagement across the globe and all of these things. And, you know, several countries are left to their fate, certainly the ones in Africa and many more across the globe, like Afghanistan. But 9/11 causes the U.S. to think about all of this. The problem with that is 10 years is a long time, right? A lot of things can change. The U.S. simply lost track of how much events have changed dramatically, because don't forget, Africa, unlike many parts of the world, is very young. You know, most of the population is very young. Most of the population is still very young. The median age in Africa is 19, thereabout. In some countries like Niger, it's about 15, actually. So you can imagine the scale of social, economic, political, demographic, technological changes. The U.S. simply can't keep up. And that's where gaps in its engagement with African countries become very clear. The U.S. simply can't be all things to all people because it doesn't have the means to do so. And then, of course, you have relationships with China, which transformed into Africa's international relations with other parts of the world. China, at this point, has become Africa's largest bilateral partner, certainly in terms of investment, infrastructural investment, and in other areas. So by the time the U.S. is ready to come back, quote unquote, a lot has changed. Don't see this. And that's where, you know, a renewed competition in terms of great power with Russia, which I would say starts in 2014, when Crimea was annexed, and when the difficulties in Donbass and the eastern part of Ukraine, when these things start to emerge. And then, of course, the election of Donald Trump, you know, sharpens competition with China. And then you have other rising powers like Turkey, the Gulf states. All of these entities have been building up a footprint in Africa. The U.S. had no clue about all of this. So by the time the U.S. is ready to start engaging with Africa again, it found that it was a problem. So that really is the sense of how great power competition in Africa, you know, was thought of. And in then and now, you know, in the 20th century, the competitors were very few. It was the United States, primarily the former European colonial powers, and the Soviet Union, China to a much lesser extent, but China certainly was a competitor. Now you have China, you have India, you have European Union, you have Russia, you have Turkey, you have Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Japan, I can keep going. So the U.S. has no idea to deal with any of this, because the U.S. thinks, oh, we're the superpower. We've had all these programs, PEPFAR, the African Growth Opportunity Act, that can sustain the relationship. The problem is time had gone by.
Interesting. Very interesting perspective. So when we look at the 20th century, or even let's start from the 19th century and see Africa's relation with Estana, like the former colonial powers, it was more extractive. It was more, okay, there was that, you know, extractive colonial forceful stuff. Then we come to the 20th century. It's more, you know, the competition for power between America and Soviet. It was more like, you know, bipolar world. And I will come to after then. We see, so in your analysis, you said Africa was young at the time. And Africa didn't have, you know, the mechanism to take on the things that were being foisted on it. You know, all of this multi-party, free trade, free that. But now we see that African countries have, in the 21st century now, post-millennium, would we say, so this revived or renewed and expansive or expanded, you know, geopolitical competition. Now, the Africa then, which have been 20 or 30 years after independence, now with Africa that's about 60, 70 years or roughly about 60 years independence. Yeah. What role do you think this new Africa is playing to navigate Or what I'm trying to say, what agency does it have? Does it have agency in all of this? Is it exploring all of this to its own advantage? Because we see, even during the bipolar war, some of the authoritarian government, military coup, they use that to entrench their authoritarian hold on power. So are we seeing a new, is that what is happening? Because we're seeing the rise of military leaders now in the 21st century, whereas where we see, when some academics will say, oh, this is different from the military leaders of then, because this was, they're not holding on to power. But we're seeing that that is changing now with alliances of states in Niger and all of that. So is there a change? Is there a difference between the Africa of then and now in terms of how they navigate all of this geopolitical competition?
There are differences and there are similarities for sure. The similarities are generally that, you know, Africa's place in the international system in comparative terms, you know, is still marginal. You know, African countries, you know, whether you think of share and volume of trade, where you think of military spending, where you think of human indicators of social progress and whatnot, they are all negative. And in terms of the volume of trade, it's still small. You know, African countries, when you think of the wealthiest African country, which everyone says is Nigeria, it's still not a $1 trillion economy, right? You know, and you think of the fact that, if anything, Nigeria's gross domestic product has actually shrunk in the last decade. It was at one point said to be $500 billion, but at this point, it's projected somewhere at sort of $420 billion, so it's actually shrunk, right? South Africa's economy has taken a beating practically since 1994. Well, it started in the 1980s, really, with the end of apartheid, but it worsened because so many of the transitional activities of moving toward a multi-party, multiracial democracy was not accompanied by, you know, wealth and income redistribution and all of these things. So Africa's place is still, you know, relatively on the periphery. You know, the great powers still dominate the UN Security Council, for instance. The great powers still dominate US military spending. I just saw some figures this morning, for instance, about defense spending in the world. And the US is still the runaway leader, but right behind it are countries like China, the European powers, Russia. So Africa's, you know, place as a, you know, decider, to use George W. Bush's language, is still quite still, right? So African countries are still, you know, on the receiving end of key outputs from the great powers, from the international system. Now, what is different is that, you know, African countries have a multiplicity of partners, you know, as I described earlier on, where, you know, you had in the 19th century, you had the colonial experience, or the beginning of the colonial experience, the slave trade. Before that, the 20th century, the transition, and then the Cold War. And then, you know, now you have a range of partners. So I've talked about China and how much that relationship has been transformative in terms of Africa's international relations. But then there are also other players, as I mentioned, Turkey and the UAE, the Gulf states. So African countries are increasingly unwilling to have a quote-unquote partner of choice, right? You know, for instance, here in West Africa, the French have long had what I call a right of first refusal when it comes to relations with their bilateral relationships with those states, where, you know, countries like Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal, Niger were always, you know, France was the first point for anything, for trade, for investment, for security relations, anything. That's changing a lot now. You know, France is still a major player in the region, to be sure. And I think a lot of what I read about how French influence is dying, this and that, is frankly uninformed. But it is true that African countries have a multiplicity of options. And that in itself can be empowering. Unfortunately, I don't see much evidence that African governments are empowering themselves using the availability of multiple players. And the reason I say this is that so many of the old patterns in terms of, for instance, bilateral economic relations are replaying themselves. So in recent years, you've had the United Arab Emirates emerge as a, you know, big player economically, especially in East Africa, which faces you know, that part of the world. So they are buying up a lot of farmland. They are buying up a lot of ports, for instance. They're investing in a lot of airports, so many other pieces of physical infrastructure. These deals are very extractive. They are not very transparent. Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, all these countries are deeply involved, I should also note, in many brutal conflicts in the region, including Sudan. The war in Sudan, you know, the complicity of the UAE is overwhelming, to the point that some other neighboring countries like Chad are essentially doing the bidding of the UAE in Sudan. So, you know, I don't see much evidence that African countries are thinking strategically about how to, you know, use some of these partnerships to their advantage. That's a major distinction, I think, from the 20th century, where African leaders at that time, for whatever criticisms may be leveled at them, thought much about international relations and how to leverage them to the advantage of their countries. You think of a place like Angola, where the government there leveraged Cuba's and Soviet assistance to ward off South Africa's pernicious influence there. You think of Nigeria's foreign policy in the 20th century, which was one of non-alignment with either the West and the Soviet Union. That came in very handy, for instance, when the Nigerian state fought the Biafran War, because both Britain and the Soviet Union supported the Nigerian side. You think of other, you know, other countries like Mali, for instance, where it retained its relationship with France, its colonial power, but pivoted toward the Soviet Union. So in many, you had, and then you have places like Uganda, Tanzania, where they more or less stood, you know, apart from this great power competition between the West and the Soviet Union. So African countries had a sense of, African governments had a sense of their place in the world. Today, there's not evidence of that. African governments, for instance, will sign just about anything you put in front of them. They go to all of these forums. Like, I think of, and this is something I've written about a lot, like there's a US-Africa forum, there's a Russia-Africa forum, there's a Japan-Africa forum, there's a China-Africa, there's an Italy-Africa forum, there's a Korea, Saudi, the list is endless. But there doesn't seem to, everyone has an Africa strategy. There's India has an Africa strategy, but there doesn't seem to be an Africa strategy by Africans. And this points to the weakness in, you know, I would say the intellectual development of the political class. And that's a key difference I see. You know, this sense of, you know, regional cooperation, for instance, it's talked more about the, but the outputs are declining. It's actually harder, I would say. I remember as a child, you know, traveling this continent, it was so much easier, certainly in West Africa, where you could, you know, I remember many times driving the West African highway from Lagos all the way to here in Senegal, certainly to Ghana, it was very doable. Now you can barely get out of Lagos. You know, all of these things point to ways in which the African continent has actually become more insular among itself. You know, there is, you know, much less cooperation, in my view, despite the expansion of opportunities to do so. All of these countries seem to want to prioritize foreign partnerships over regional and continental ones, despite the fact that the prevailing evidence elsewhere around the world is that, you know, transformative development is actually more likely when you do it in concert with each other. When you think of things like the flying geese theory and how that works in economics, foreign partners are less likely to help you get to where you want to get to, for the simple reason that they are not in your network, they are not in your ecosystem. But African countries don't seem to understand that. So that's, those are some of the differences as well as the similarities I've described.
Very, very amazing. I'm going to come to that. I'll come to how that might also relate to the structure of the African state, or look at its history, its formation, and is the African states, nations or states, statehood and nation. But I want to go to something else. It's true, you've mentioned China and how China has become the dominant trade partner, you know, its influence in Africa. But it's been one that is, unlike the Western nations, where from your analysis as well, where you see when the US emerged as the victor after the Cold War. They start imposing. You could see imposing on this, then imposing conditions, human rights conditions, and all of that. But in China's case, China's policy of non-interference in whatever. China is like in DRC. I know China controls nearly 90% of the mining. This thing, and that has created some sort of competition between China and the United States, and even all the like Turkey and all of that stuff. But what I wanted to say is, in my experience, like meetings that I go to here in Europe and in among the Western world, there's in those private meetings, the Western world seems to be more worried about China and China's influence in. But we've also seen, but China has been able to remain elusive in the way because it doesn't. What is the scope of Chinese influence, and how much does it contribute? So you mentioned something very iconic, how these countries like UAE contribute to the conflict in Sudan. I've heard that Chinese also contribute to in the Horn of Africa and in East Africa, how they support the rebels in all those places. What is the scope of Chinese influence?
The Chinese footprint, as you alluded to, with its policy of non-interference, has been relatively more discreet on political issues. Now, first of all, my view is that the policy of non-interference is a form of interference. There is no such thing as sitting on the fence. Every decision you make has a consequence, and the zero-sum nature of decision-making is such that someone somewhere is less than thrilled with the decision you've made. So especially in a high-stakes situation like a conflict, you will be viewed by one side or the other as having taken it. So I think China's policy of non-interference, it's far more theoretical than it's practical. But be that as it may, China has often decided against getting too involved in anything in the non-economic realm. There are reasons for that, mainly the fact that it recognizes that it simply doesn't have the capacity to do so. Chinese diplomats don't always have the vast knowledge of every part of the continent and on every issue. And they recognize that, so they play to their strengths. The U.S., conversely, tends to want to do everything, at least that's its MO. For instance, in a U.S. embassy, you have a public affairs officer, economic officer, political officer, you have a defense officer, defense attaché. The U.S. comes with the, might of Uncle Sam. It has the resources, certainly, to do all of those things. The problem is that its ability is not nearly as even-handed as its resources. So the U.S. tends to want to throw everything against the wall in search of what sticks, thereby making so many mistakes and offsetting its actual strengths by its weaknesses in other areas. The Chinese seem to want to do less of that. They want to play up to their strengths and piggyback off others in their weaker areas. So, for instance, the Chinese appointed a special envoy to the Horn of Africa in 2022. In real terms, the envoy hasn't actually done a whole lot. Again, that's because this person didn't have a whole lot of experience on the continent, certainly not in the Horn of Africa. They didn't have the knowledge base. This person didn't know who the key players in major parts of that region, like Ethiopia, Djibouti, and all of these places. Mm-hmm. So, the Chinese have, from time to time, demonstrated a willingness to show that, oh, look, we are not just about building roads and bridges and all of that in Africa. We are also, a major player. And I think that's where some of its mistakes have come to the fore. But generally speaking, that's not been the Chinese anymore. The Chinese I'm more than happy, despite what people think, to leverage the Western security presence on the continent, the Western security partnerships. They're a beneficiary of that because they feel like, the West does the security stuff with these African governments. We do the economic stuff. So you can see the way in which China's, footprint on the continent is shrewd, advantageous, Some might think, some Western commentators would see cynical, but the Chinese would see it as realistic because that's they feel like that's where their capabilities can best come to the fore. So that's generally how China tends to operate. As I say, increasingly, it's coming out of the shadows a little more. And that's because, you know, with the current the government in China of Xi Jinping, China is asserting itself more. It no longer views itself as just some kind of investor. You know, it's not some global VC, for instance, that throws money. Hey, here's some money for a port. Hey, here's some money for a bridge, an industrial park. China actually sees itself as much more than that. It wants to be a guarantor of some sort. You know, whether it can do that in the ways that, say, the Western powers are, you know, accustomed to doing remains to be seen. I have my doubts about that, personally speaking, but, you know, we shall see. But yes, China is slowly and carefully trying to emerge as a much more of a major power in the ways that, you know, it thinks is befitting of it.
Another country that is trying to emerge, have some major role in Africa is Russia. So we've seen a growing influence of Russia, maybe in Central African Republic. We've seen it in places like Sudan, Libya. We've seen, especially in the Sahel, where we've seen, you know, a number of coups. And a lot of people feel, in my talking to some people feel like it seems like Russia's influence is exaggerated. Some people also feel like, from the African perspective, some people feel like there is that popular disillusionment, or, you know, with Western presence, and we've seen Western presence, you know, that has led to them retreating. You know, they kind of you know, frustration has been expressed, the popular uprising against, you know, especially in former French colonies, you've seen French. And then recently, the Americans have been asked to leave in Niger. We've seen all of this rising, and it looks like Russia is filling that vacuum. But how much of this? Because a lot of people say this is Russia disinformation. Russia doesn't have that capacity. Russia doesn't have that in terms of trade. It doesn't command, you know, it doesn't have just what you're talking about. So how much of this is, what is the scope of Russian influence or growing influence in Africa? Let's start from that, I think.
So I'm personally one of those people who believes that Russia's so-called influence is overstated. And I think when you look at the prevailing evidence in its totality, that's the key here, its totality. So Africa is not the Sahel. Africa is 54, 55 countries. If your frame of reference for Africa is the Sahel, then of course it would look like, you know, Russia is all over the place. But as I said, there are 55 countries. The trade volume, for instance, between Russia and Africa's 55 countries is about 20 billion. That's, I don't know, about 500 million per country thereabouts. If that's a lot of influence, then I don't know what influence means. In Niger, Russia doesn't even have an embassy. In Burkina Faso, they only, you know, reopened the embassy there last year after got many decades. You know, you look at Nigeria, there is no prevailing evidence of Russian influence. East Africa, there is no prevailing evidence of Russian influence. So as I say, you have to be thoughtful and level-headed when you talk about, and I know it's generally very difficult for Western analysts and commentators, policymakers, because their countries are locked in a geopolitical competition with Russia. So, you know, they are bound to, you know, biases they have, you know, and professional as well as ideological interests they hold are bound to make them overstate the scope of what is actually happening. Coupled with the fact that most of them simply don't know what is actually happening on African countries. They don't live there. They don't speak the languages of these countries. At best, they visit for a couple of weeks. If they do, they stay in capital cities. They talk to usually political, security, economic elites. They stay in cities, you know, whereas many of these countries, certainly in the Sahel, are mostly rural, right? So these people who write and speak so much about these places simply have no idea what they're talking about a lot of the time. You know, so, you know, there is a preponderance of evidence to show that, if anything, Russian influence is actually weakening in the more holistic sense, because as I mentioned, there are other players who are more visible, at least are doing more visible things in tangible ways that people recognize. You know, when you look at the Sahel, Russia's influence may be growing relative to what it was before, because as I say, in some of these countries I mentioned, they had no embassy, they had no footprint. You know, I saw so many, you know, people say there's some sort of Russian involvement in Niger or the two coups in Burkina Faso, despite all of the evidence showing that the Russians were actually surprised when it happened. They were caught off guard. But now they welcomed the coup because they saw it as an opportunity to weaken French influence in the region. And that opportunity exists largely because of the unpopularity of France. So to the extent that Russia is gaining any influence, it's because other players have allowed it.
Okay, go on.
And domestic elites have come to the conclusion they want a partnership with Russia. That's the most important element in all of this.
Yes, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. So it is, I think that I agree with you that Russia's involvement in, I agree with you that Russia's involvement may be more opportunistic. But then again, the new elements that you've mentioned, it's the kind of warm reception towards Russia. So we can look at it from the elite perspective, which you can say, well, elite wants to perpetuate themselves in power. They want to consolidate that grip on power, the coup plotters. But then again, we look at it in terms of the public as well. There seems to be a public support for Russia and an anti-Western narrative. So how do you balance that? Do you say there's a legitimate, genuine quest for Russian support from the public, if the public is, or is that an illusion as well?
Yeah, so again, this is a talking point I hear very often. You know, when I go on international media, this proposition is often put to me, I often asked to me, oh, what do you say about the public holding Russian flags and pro-Russian sentiment on, you know, the internet and on social media? All of these things. Again, you have to look at these things in a totality. First of all, what's the evidence base of this supposed pro-Russian sentiment? Again, it comes from cities, 9 out of 10 times. People will look at a rally in Ouagadougou or Bamako or Niamey, and that is the evidence base to make a statement about an entire country. No polling data, no surveys, no extensive research in communities outside of these cities. No. People look at one protest in one city, because it's not numbers, it's usually one. The capital, usually Niamey, Ouagadougou, and Bamako. People look at these things and let me flip this around. Imagine if I wrote a story about, you're in the UK, about the UK, and my evidence base was a sprinkling of protests from London. Would you take such an analysis serious? You probably wouldn't. So why is that seen as reasonable and acceptable to do to African countries? That's always my question here. The people who write these stories, they know nothing about these places. Many of them have never been there. Many of them can't point these places out on a map, but they have a story to write. You know, they have targets. I understand the pressures of international media. Hey, I work in that world now. But, you know, when you have the responsibility of informing the public, you have a duty to be responsible. You have a duty to be thoughtful. So if you are not able to do so, you are failing your audience. You are absolving yourself of the responsibility to be thoughtful, especially when you are dealing with complicated matters. You know, there isn't any extensive evidence of, you know, the popularity of Russia in any of these places that I've seen. Perhaps that might change. You know, I don't want to make it seem as though trends are stuck in place. It may change, I don't know. But based on the prevailing evidence we have today, at best, what you see as somebody who goes to many of these rallies, for instance, who goes to these countries, who, you know, stays in communities in these places, you know, one thing I hear very often is that, look, we're not fans of the Russians, but we see this opportunity to get rid of French influence in our country as one we should take. And we know how much waving Russian flags pisses off, you know, the French embassy, for instance, pisses off the French government. And that's why we are doing. People say these things very openly. I don't, perhaps again, because these people who write don't know what they are talking about and have never been to these. But people say these things. That you will go to a rally, for instance, you will literally find people making Russian flags. Again, it's Russia's footprint, to the extent it exists, is opportunistic. It's the Russians have detected that French policy is unpopular in the region. Let's weaken it by any means possible. So is there Russian disinformation, quote unquote? Yes, but then there's also French disinformation. Every great power dabbles in disinformation. Why then does the Russian element get all the airtime and the French get none of it? When French or American influence operations are done in African countries, they'll say it's shaping public opinion, you know? But when it's Russia, it's disinformation. Does this not speak to you as ideological agendas masquerading as analysis? So, you know, the way to think about all these things is be level head, you know. You have to look at the prevailing evidence everywhere, not just in a handful of places that suit your agenda.
Interesting, very interesting analysis. I think I agree with you. I wanted you mentioned UAE's influence in Sudan, because sometimes we focus on this names, China, Russia, America, the West, Europe, and there's no spotlight on this. There's no spotlight on these middle powers and world influence they exert. So I wanted to speak on that before we come to.
There's a quote that Turkish President Recep Erdogan always says, like, the world is bigger than five, right? And he refers to the five powers on the five permanent members of the UN Security Council. That's always been a UN sort
Security
of...
Security Council.
Right. That's always been a framework for his engagement with the world, right? And especially on the African continent. And I think when you look at... in West Africa, for instance, Erdogan has kind of positioned himself as, because he's been in power for so long, he's positioned Russian, Turkish engagement with Africa as distinct to everything else and everyone else. Yeah. It's not Western, it's not Chinese, you know, it's Turkish, you know, and to do that, he leverages on, you know, a lot of cultural and religious linkages between Muslim Turkey and majority countries in West Africa, like Senegal, Mali, Guinea. So in many African countries, particularly in this part of the continent, you have Turkish schools, you have Turkish hospitals, cultural centers. these schools and cultural centers and hospitals are quite popular. They are generally perceived to be quite well run. Turkish goods are really growing and thriving. You know, Turkish trade with Africa has increased dramatically from 2005, when the relationship broke out in a strategic sense, to date. So that's been almost 20 years now. You know, Turkey has opened up many more embassies than it once had, certainly back then. So, you know, Erdogan has sort of done all of this to essentially position himself as being able to deliver, certainly in the economic realm and commercial realm, European quality goods at Chinese costs, if that makes sense. Like, Chinese goods are obviously not going to be as cheap as Turkish, but it's expensive as Western, as European and American. So Erdogan, again, has tried to be sort of strategic about his approach into Africa. Turkish Airlines, for instance, flies from more than 20 to 25 African cities, including Lagos, Johannesburg, Cairo. It's a very popular airline for travelers, especially ones who are trying to get to Europe and the Middle East. So there are ways in which the Turkish state has sought to take advantage of opportunities presented to it, but also find them, right? And I think that when you look at what's happening with other players, you know, like even in Malaysia, like even in Indonesia, in Singapore, there are so many more interesting stories to be told about African international relations in ways that, you know, are far more interesting than the needless obsession with Russia, China, the United States, the European Union. Yes, they are important, they are meaningful, but they are not the full spectrum of Africa's relations.
Come to conclude by doing like more like a projection to look at what is going to be how is this going to play out eventually, because we, from what you've described, which I agree with you, it looks like, you know, Africa is not gaining a lot from this diversity. But we've then seen again, I don't know if these are just paper policies or paper stuff. We've seen the African continental free trade. We've seen, you know, the aid problems. So are all of these concepts, are they just spoken in principle and not practical? How do they position Africa in international relations?
Yeah, you know, I think that I'm generally a supporter of Africa seeking more international partners for itself.
I don't know if you got my question.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I'm generally a supporter of Africa, you know, gaining more international partners and trying to integrate regionally and continentally. But the ways and means also matter, you know, to the point I was making about some of these partnerships being replicas of old patterns. You don't sign a deal for the sake of saying you signed a deal, right? And too often, governments get into this habit of this very technocratic approach to bilateral relationships. So you have government, for instance, touting, oh, we went up 20 places on the ease of doing business index. You know, so I remember during the administration of former President Muhammadu Buhari, during the first, as part of their re-election manifesto, they kept shouting about how, oh, Nigeria went up 24 places on the ease of doing business index. That's neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned, because the bottom line, though, is the ease of business actually better in Nigeria? If that is the question, there are very few Nigerians who would say yes. The cost of business, if anything, keeps going up. You know, registering a company is very difficult. Getting electricity, paying taxes, the indicators, you know, of actual in actual business environment, few Nigerians will tell you it got better under Buhari. So if going up the ease of doing business index is supposed to mean anything, then what is it? If, you know, your argument is that by climbing up a ranking that can easily be gamed and has been demonstrated to have been gamed several times such that it was discontinued, actually, if that is what you are touting, then what are you doing here? This is all a rhetorical exercise. This is not actually about improving livelihood. So too many African governments are in this business of doing things for the sake of saying they have done something. Oh, we signed a free trade agreement. Oh, we signed the, you know, bilateral this and that and the other thing. Oh, we signed the, you know, free trade. The point is, how does that improve your bottom line? How does it make businesses more prosperous? How does it create opportunities for them? How does it open up markets abroad for your traders, for your entrepreneurs, for your financial services firms? These are the ways to think about all of these things. Not writing lists about what deal you signed, and that's not an accomplishment. So I think that African governments, and this is where I bemoan the influence of the World Bank and the IMF, have come to see policy making, especially on the economic front, as a bunch of checking of boxes and, you know, writing of lists of things you have done. But, you know, signing all the deals in the world doesn't necessarily mean that your bottom line is better. Sometimes not signing a deal is better than signing a, actually I would say all the time, not signing a deal is better than signing a bad one. And there is simply too much evidence of African governments signing bad deals just to say they have signed deals, just to say, oh, so right now I see, for instance, President Tinubu's administration talking about seeking foreign investors. Yeah, we're running around, we're looking for investors. They're going to India, they're going to UAE, you know, they're going to spring meetings. We're looking for investors, this, that, and the other thing. But what are they actually doing to make business in Nigeria for Nigerians better? So this has to be, that way of thinking about these kinds of international engagements has to change. You have to tie them to material outcomes. If businesses aren't improving their bottom line, if people's livelihoods aren't getting better, incomes aren't rising, poverty rates aren't reducing, then what does it matter what deals you're signing?
It's been a very good time, you know, having this conversation with you, and I've really enjoyed the talk. And it's quite sad sometimes when you look at, you know, the transition, and, you know, you think there should be some change, some lessons that I've learned from past engagements with Esther and then come. But it looks like I've not really learned that lesson. And Africa is, you know, it looks like, again, it's going through the cycle. It looks like it's a cycle where Africa is just being raped and ripped apart. But you've also mentioned, you know, like we need to look beyond the surface. We need to look beyond, you know, what is being presented in the media and look outside those capital cities, outside of the stuffs, the reality on the ground. So I really enjoyed our conversation, and, you know, I can only wish we, you know, things we there'll be like a change, you know, and hopefully we'll call you back again. We look forward to enjoy this conversation. I'll call you back again and see, perhaps we'll look at what players, I'm already thinking about what I'm asking to talk about, what new players in Africa, because you mentioned the youth, you mentioned the median age of the youth, and the youth are really taking that position in terms of, if you look at Nigeria, you look at Senegal, we have a very young president. You look at Nigeria in the last election, the youth taking charge. So I might call you. We might invite you again to come and look at what that demographic is, that what it portends
for the change in Africa. But for now, I'm really grateful for your commentary, and keep you posted once the episode is going to be published, and would encourage you to help, you know, share among your network. And I'll keep in touch with you personally. I like the work you do, so I'll keep in touch personally. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity.
You're welcome. Thank you for tuning in today's week's episode. I want to really thank Chris for his excellent analysis of the great power competition in Africa and the myth of the Russian influence in Africa. I'm grateful to Chris. Join me to thank him, and I encourage you to tune in again next week for other insightful and exciting episode and commentary on Africa. For now, say bye, and I'll see you next week.